The following presentation was recorded live, February 14th through the 17th, at the McHenry Convention Center in San Jose, California, for RSA Conference 2006. We take you live, where our session is just getting underway.
Okay. To give you a real short one, we have a family called the Rich family, and it had two father and mother, Richie Rich and Farley Rich, who died a while ago. And they have a son, Riley Rich, and they have a daughter named Agne Rich, think pig Latin, she's a nag. And they have developed a dispute because there have been some changes in the estate planning documents. Years ago, Riley Rich and Farley Rich had a revocable living trust in California, which disposed of their property quite in ways you might expect. Two trustees are their two children, and the property is more or less divided equally between them, except that Riley Rich, who spends most of his time cultivating his golf handicap, received all of the golf-oriented tangible property owned by the decedents. And Agne received some jewelry in China and things like that. But the major asset is a very valuable code, software code, which is licensed out by a family company called LLC, and it has been deposited for safekeeping in Steel Summit, an escrow or depository, in a format which is the code is put in there. It is kept secret from anyone else by Steel Mountain. They have issued a token, a hardware token, which gives access to the container that holds this code. And it's possible that the token also has decryption capability for the way that the material is stored inside the container. In any event, the token has acquired the shape of a golf bag so that it resembles some of the golf-related equipment that has been disposed of by the will. We've had some discussion with Steel Summit, and we sort of worked out a method here where the judge has been asked to, it's okay, the Steel Summit will go along whatever order the judge makes as to the ownership of the property, but if that requires Steel Summit to go outside of its agreements and its policy practices, its privacy practices, it would like to have further opportunity to discuss that with the judge. So it would not like, for example, the judge to declare someone the owner of the property and then give the access to the decryption to someone else, and it wouldn't like to be forced to use a last resort decryption capability. After the first trust was signed with that basic plan, there was another amendment, a second amendment, which was done in electronic format because times moved on and people are doing that for convenience and lack of expense. And the second one was done, everything was done right. It was a PKI designed to be robust and reliable. It was done under the auspices of a law firm which did retain the registration authority to validate the issuance of certificates, but outsourced all the back end to a big cert, large certificate authority, which had all of the correct precautions, and all of the procedures were set up so that that this could not have been invaded by someone who wanted to spoof or get a signature, get a certificate issued to the wrong person. In stark contrast to the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, also electronic, just appeared in the form of a digital document, which Agne, who is the proponent of that document, produced and tried to have enforced by this court. And this document is totally under the control of the company that Agne has totally controls herself. She has technical ability. She's the architect of the system. She had, when you really track it through, the witness had to admit that she could have issued certificates to herself in the name of Richie Rich, because there was not secure time dating facilities, could have successfully papered the record, the logs, and changed all the dates. So you have on the other extreme of a PKI that is totally unreliable. And all of this was brought out through first the direct testimony of Hoyt Kesterson, who first established that the First Amendment was the ideal use of the technology, and then when dealing with the second use of the technology was very sparse in direct examination and explaining some of the differences, which were legion, and cross-examination brought out all of those contrasts that I mentioned. Anything else that I should cover before you have your closing arguments?
Think so. What I would just say is we probably should be very quick in terms of our closing.
Okay. Mr. Eisen, would you like to close, please?
Your Honor, this is a serious case, and the charges here are serious. Ms. Agnew Rich here, though there is not a marshal at the door to arrest her as she leaves, what is at stake here is nothing less than the accusation that she's committed a felony. If she forged these documents, that is a serious charge. Mr. Wu, in his opening, said the nub here is that quite possibly she did. Your Honor, quite possibly is not enough. Your Honor should first examine the law and then look at the fact, not speculation, not quite possibly. The law. The law is, if a law requires a signature, an electronic signature satisfies the law. Now, what are the facts here? What are the facts in support of the contention that Agnew forged this signature? There is circumstantial evidence that she had the possibility, possibly the motive, but what are the facts that she did it? Is there any evidence here that she actually changed any timestamps? Is there any evidence here that she was complicit with anybody in her company, any administrator? There is not a single thing like that here, Your Honor. All there is, ultimately, is this single screaming fact that Richie Rich set up a system that said that there would be a lot of controls here which, if satisfied, would verify that he had signed digitally an amendment to this. And that's exactly what happened here, and there are no facts to the contrary.
Mr. Wu?
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to go over some of these facts. As my colleague pointed out, the fact is that the credential in question for the Second Trust Amendment was issued December 24th, and the Second Trust Amendment was 1 week later. And it just happened to be very shortly before Mr. Rich died. How convenient it was that the certificate was issued just 1 week before it was needed, and how convenient it was that it was issued such a short time before the death of Mr. Rich. The testimony here shows how insecure the process was by which the certificate was issued by Rich LLC. It is quite possible, as the testimony showed, and it's not disputed by Agnew Rich's expert, that Agnew Rich could have engineered the process to issue a certificate herself without anybody else being involved, have a key pair on a machine, sign the Second Trust Amendment in the name of Mr. Rich, and no one could have said otherwise because there were no logs, no timestamp to show anything else. In comparison, we see how it could have been done right in the case of the law firm. The law firm had a secure system, had approval processes by which only the RA, the Registration Authority Administrator, the paralegal could have approved the certificate application, and the certificate was issued from a secure data center. Recall also that Ms. Rich is a super user and head of information systems at Rich LLC. So there are several ways by which the system could be compromised. Your Honor, you do not have to find that the compromise occurred in any particular way, but understand that cumulatively, all of these show how easy it could have been to compromise the system in this case. Ms. Rich could have issued a certificate herself. She could have generated the request for the certificate herself and approved it without anybody's intervention, no logs to show otherwise. Note that this certificate is for business use. Rich LLC is not in the business of estate planning, so already there is an irregularity. There is weak protection on the certification authority system that sits in a closet in the Rich LLC offices. Agnew Rich had the key to that closet. She could have gotten in, she could have logged onto the system and issued a certificate herself. The signing platform, these are company laptops, no privacy, no password protection other than the logon, and she had super user privileges to sign on behalf of anybody on any machine in Rich LLC. She could have done it by herself right before Mr. Rich died. But in addition, it is quite possible that she could have done it even after Mr. Rich died and engineered the whole thing by setting back system clocks to show that it took place before Mr. Rich's death. The bottom line is that Ms. Rich had the means of forging the signature for Mr. Rich. I understand that this is serious, but, Your Honor, you don't even have to find that a forgery actually took place. You don't have to find, as my colleague said, that it's quite possible that the forgery took place. Why? Because Mr. Isom and his client have the burden of showing that this document is what it claims to be. They have the burden of proof. They have not satisfied that burden of proof, Your Honor. So we ask that you disregard the Second Trust Amendment, rule in favor of Mr. Rich, granting him rights as a joint beneficiary with Agnew Rich to the code at Steel Summit and giving him joint rights as successor trustee in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wu. Mr. Isom, I hope you have nothing further. Thank you. This is the opinion of the Santa Clara County Superior Court Probate Division, given just from the bench based on the evidence as I've seen it. It would be typically cleaned up later, but here's the way one trial judge might go through it. I'm not going to give the facts again. They would have been recited. It also would have had a caption, and it would have recited who the parties are and who their counsel are. Then we would go through the issues as follows. UETA. At trial, respondent Riley Rich moved to declare Amendment Number 2 unenforceable on the grounds that it was excluded from the type of electronic document that the California version of UETA allows. California Civil Code 1633.1 refuses to deny validity and enforceability of a document on the grounds that it is an electronic format. As an exception to that section, 1633.3b1 excludes from this rule a list of testamentary documents that includes wills, codicils, and testamentary trusts, but does not mention the type of electronic document present in this case, namely a revocable living trust that does not require probate on the death of the creator or a beneficiary. On this issue, I hold that UETA does allow a revocable living trust to be valid and enforceable despite being in electronic format on the statutory construction principle that to express one is to exclude others, and that the legislature would have said it differently if it meant differently. I confirm that my denial of respondent's motion at trial with the effect that the mere fact that it is an electronic format is not a barrier to enforceability. That does not end the hurdles which a document in electronic format must pass. As has been briefed, UETA requires some symbol, sound, process, etc., evidencing an intent to sign the document and to be bound by it. I find that the requisite intent exists, whoever signed it, but it's obvious that this begs the question in a case like this which raises the question of whether the amendment was signed by the decedent, Richie, therefore to be a valid amendment by him, or by someone else who has spoofed the digital signature of the decedent. Agnew Rich, who is the proponent of Amendment Number 2, has produced an expert witness, Hoyt Kesterson, who explained the so-called digital signature technology that can create a chain of inferences which can be used by a fact finder to reasonably support the conclusion that a certain person and none other digitally signed an electronic document. This is really a case of first impression of any case I've seen in Santa Clara County Probate Division, and in fact in the world. As I understand it from Mr. Kesterson's testimony, a cryptographic key is divided, or value is divided, into two mathematically related keys, a private key used to sign the document and a public key used to verify that the corresponding private key was the one used to sign. The signer is careful, and this is a very key element, is careful to retain exclusive possession of the private signing key, but the public key is freely available to any who might need it to verify the signature. The public key is bound with the identity of the holder of the corresponding private key by a digital certificate which contains both the public key and the distinguished name of the holder of the corresponding signing key. By combining the key cryptographically with a hash of the entire document, it is also possible to determine that there has not been any modification of the document since it was signed. On direct examination by counsel for Agnew, Mr. Kesterson explained a number of precautions taken to ensure the reliability of the digital signature on Amendment 1, which was the first electronic amendment accomplished by the Rich family's law firm. He then testified that the technology of the second digital signature on Amendment Number 2 was the same. But upon cross-examination by Mr. Wu, it became apparent that indeed there were significant differences, and one which affect the central issue in this case. Mr. Kesterson admitted a number of areas where the precautions taken to ensure reliability were dramatically lessened in the case of Amendment Number 2, the amendment in dispute in this case. And I'm going to take the liberty of taking the recording of Mr. Wu's closing argument for the list of all of those differences, because I've never heard it said better. I've also never heard a better argument based on very little by Mr. Isom. On the basis of Mr. Kesterson's testimony, Petitioner Agnew offered both amendments number 1 and number 2 in evidence. There was no objection to number 1 from Riley Rich, except for continuing objection under UATA, as to which he can take his appeal if he wishes, but I doubt he will. But Mr. Riley objected to admission of number 2, Riley Rich objected to Amendment 2 for lack of foundation, namely the requirement that before evidence is put into evidence, it be authenticated, it has to be shown to be what it is, or otherwise there's no point in the court paying any attention to it. In this case, some evidence that it is the digital signature of decedent Richie Rich. I ruled that the testimony that based upon the fact that of Federal Rule 901B9, which I think might be applied, the reasoning of it in California, that a process designed to show the accuracy, testimony designed to show the accuracy that a process produces an accurate result is in fact the right way to go to get in a digital signature. And this was sufficient to overcome the objection of the foundation insufficient foundation for the document. So I did decide as to the evidence question that I would allow it, and we did. We did not at that point decide as to what weight the evidence should be given or its persuasiveness. The parties briefed the burden of proof, and without going too deeply, there are really two different kinds of burdens of proof. One is called production burden, which is sort of like a ping pong ball that goes back and forth in trial, that you have to satisfy this amount of proof in order to have whatever you're asserting at that point dismissed. And after you satisfy that production burden, then perhaps it passes to the other side, who then has to put in some production burden in order to avoid having the fact held against him. This is quite apart from what the layman think of most when they think of burden of proof. You all know criminal trials have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Most civil cases have the preponderance of the evidence, which is 51% of the evidence, the feeling that it's more than half. So that would be the burden of proof that is the burden of proof that I'm applying in this case, that the proponent of a document, Agne, must satisfy the burden of, we call it the risk of non-persuasion of the fact finder with a preponderance of the evidence. If there were a jury, that's the way I would instruct the jury to decide, that they must decide if they're going to decide in favor of Agne, they must decide that there's a preponderance of evidence in favor of the fact that Richie Rich signed this trust amendment, however he did it. We have other testimony which would be weighed by the fact finder, because Agne Rich did testify that she didn't do anything wrong, but I am going to, well, without intending to accuse her, Mr. Isom, of committing a forgery or perjury or anything like that, I'm going to observe that she had the motive. She was angry and felt that she deserved to receive the lion's share of the estate, and said so at every single opportunity. She was technically qualified. She was the architect of the system and had the run of the place. And there were, as was pointed out, there were a number of ways which she had clearly the opportunity to pull this off without detection. So it's a hard call, but I am going to find that the petitioner, Agne, has not proved by a preponderance of the evidence that decedent Richie Rich signed amendment number 2.
Should we call the proceedings to a close?
No. I first have to decide how we're handling Steel Summit. Having decided that they were throwing out Amendment Number 2, this restores Amendment Number 1, which was just had some technical changes of the original plan, which is an equal division among the two siblings, and they're both co-trustees. I'm sure they're going to get along really well as co-trustees, and that's where I'm going to leave them. I'm going to instruct them to issue joint instructions, which they unanimously agree in writing, digitally signed, to address to Steel Summit as to what they want to do with the property as successors to the ownership of it, succeeding to the interests of their parents. However, we still have the problem of the token, because I respect Steel Summit is supporting a very important principle in an industry which is going to be increasingly important, that it is that you do not idly overcome the agreements of the parties. So I'm going to instruct Riley Rich to deposit the golf bag token into the trust with the trust assets so that he and Agne jointly use it until it's no longer needed for any purpose of getting at the data in the depository, and then Richie may have the token. I think that just about does it. I am here for any further relief requested by the parties if they have trouble agreeing. Thank you very much. This case is closed. Now we have all this, we plan to have all this time for questions. Now this is really, some of you are frustrated in other sessions because you don't have time for questions. We're really interested in any new theories that you might have if you were in this position. Steve, why don't you be the moderator? Yes,
I certainly will. Before we begin, I just wanted to say what a pleasure and a privilege it has been to work with these folks
all of whom I consider to be masters, and it is so wonderful to see the benefit of how they would operate in real life and see the benefit to see how experienced practitioners would handle a problem like this. So I just want to say how pleased I am that I could be together up here with them doing this talk. John. Yeah, we didn't really. We were trying to isolate in the fact scenario just the signature itself. So all of the facts and circumstances around the signing, we tried to eliminate that through his death, essentially. Yeah, the question is, what about the audit trail that could have shown that a signature was created at such and such a time? I mean, I think that's part of the point in that in the Rich LLC scenario, you don't really have all of the audit circumstances that would have shown much more reliability.
Discussions about this in our group, and there was testimony you didn't see, which we talked about. I mean, the entire idea, here's a man who really wasn't in very good condition because he was at home having to be taken care of. The situation supposedly is that his son never really came to see him, and his daughter gave him loving care for a year, you know, and so that essentially it would have been argued that since his son never showed up, you know, so all this stuff would have been done. The point kept being made is this man was a technologist. You know, he didn't believe he had to call in three lawyers to do something because there was a digital signature mechanism that was doing it. So this man was laying his faith in technology on the line. I think this is something that David made clear very often in this point, you know, that he wanted it to go to a digital paper-based so that he later could do these things digitally. So I think the argument could be made, here's a man who's disappointed in his son, who appreciates that his daughter has in fact been taking care of him, who is in fact is pretty much restricted to working at home, working with his company laptop, and using mechanisms that he has some sort of faith in to digitally sign. And I would have thought that would have been a reasonably valid argument, but of course we couldn't do it. We don't have time.
Yeah, I think also in most circumstances we're going to have just the signature to go by. I don't think you're going to have extra, you know, unless it was some kind of very, very high assurance situation.
Because the whole idea is to reduce cost and complexity. If I'm going to do a digital signature and I still have to drag in three lawyers to watch me do it, what's the point?
I think there's a really important point here. If we're talking about verifying somebody's signature, there has to be a very strong tie between the person who actually is deciding to do something and the signature associated with the person. So that's the point you made. Somehow you have to tie the actual personal identity to that electronic representative of the identity.
That's the point of the whole signature.
That's right. Once you've done that tie, what you've done is you've done a validation of the electronic signature entity itself. And there's a second point that says who can then operate with that signature. So there's two different pieces that are going to be constantly in argument here. One is, how do you make sure it's the right person that was associated with the signature to start with, and how do you make sure that who used it is that same person?
Why don't we take some more questions? You, sir, with the sunglasses, please.
The HR administrator have been a key witness in this, testifying as to whether Richie Rich was the person that requested that key to be generated. If the key was generated on his behalf, which the supposition here was that it wasn't, but if it was generated on his behalff and the HR administrator authenticated it, would would that have changed the outcome of the trial, regardless of whether there was any indication as to who actually signed the document?
Better lawyers would have found that.
Yeah, the question... the question, to repeat the question, is would the HR administrator have been a key witness? Yes, the HR administrator would have been a key witness. I think for purposes of this exercise, we're going to say that the HR administrator died and was not available to be able to testify.
The second part of the question was, if the HR administrator had said that, yes, that was a valid key and that Richie Rich did ask for that key and it was given to him, the security of the key was in doubt, but would that change the outcome of the trial given the 51% proof?
The question is, would the HR administrator's testimony that he or she approved a certificate application, would it have changed the outcome? I would make the argument that it's quite possible if the person said, I saw an application coming over the wire and I approved it, and Richie Rich then later on talked to me and said, I just put in a certificate application, blah, blah, blah. Yes, that would have made a difference. But I think for purposes of our exercise, we're really focusing on other issues. So what I would also make the claim that it is possible that that would have knocked out one way that Agnew Rich could have falsified it, but it's quite possibly that she could have been the one to get onto Richie's laptop and put in a certificate application, and the HR administrator, the only thing that he or she could say is, yes, I saw an application come over the wire and I approved it, and then we would be back to where we were before. Yes, sir, in the blue.
Are you concerned at all now, any of you, that you have now set a precedent that a digital signature is not valid?
Oh, no. Yeah. That was
the question is, are we setting a precedence, or by our discussion today, indicating somehow our belief that digital signatures won't stand up in court or
won't be valid? The first one stood up. The first one stood?
I think what
that's because there was no challenge. I mean, I'd be concerned. I mean, you know, from my point of view, the only evidence was she said she didn't sign it. There was really no evidence to the contrary. The system failed. The system that Richie created failed.
I think what it also shows is that the two digital signatures were different in quality of verification. That's the key thing, and it's going to be a problem all the time.
Yeah. Hoyt?
Well, my decision said that. the second one failed a burden of proof, a burden of persuasion. It might have been by very little. Implicit in the thing is the first one did pass, but it wasn't challenged.
I'd like to make the point that I'm well known for on the ABA list a long time ago making a statement that says most people's security process seems to be we don't do that here, therefore nothing bad could have happened. And I try to make the point time and time again that not only must you be honest, not only must you appear to be honest, you must have in place a system that forces you to be honest. And if you don't take those steps, what you just saw can happen.
I would also add that it was Hoyt's idea to compare and contrast two systems, one a very secure system leading up to the certificate issuance and one an insecure system, so that we could show you how it could be done right. So the takeaway is, if you do it all the right way, it's going to stand up and maybe not even be able to be challenged in court, versus the way that it would be insecure. So I think that was very educational. I don't have a fear at all. Sir, right in front with the blue shirt and the.
You successfully used the trusted time question on the Second Amendment to refute the credibility of the CA in the issuance process. I would think on the First Amendment, you can use precisely the same argument to refute the credibility of the signature itself, because there was no policy, no OCSP check, nothing done to establish that signature was created during a period of time that the certificate.
Yeah, so the question is, could you cast doubt on the signature on the first trust amendment because there was no time stamping to show that a signature was created during the validity period of the keys? Hoyt, do you want to, or Ann, do you want to?
I would say not just the validity period of the keys, but what if the server was revoked 2 days after the issue?
Those are legal issues more than reliability issues. That would be like if we were under the Utah statute, which shifted the burden of proof. If you had everything done in proper time, But if you were, if it was not issued in the, if it was not signed in the operability period, it wouldn't reverse the burden of proof. In fact, those little legalisms, I think we're far from reaching those issues right now. I think judges would be much more interested in reliability issues than technical arguments that you're over an operability period. Although they're relevant, they're not going to decide it.
Hoyt, I might just add, maybe we should move the microphone down a little bit and have some folks use the microphone so that I don't waste time just repeating questions.
This one?
Yes.
Just
please.
Be careful because you'll get feedback if you go too far.
Jerry, do you want to come up to the microphone?
It's a question probably for Hoyt. One thing that was brought up was the usage of the certificate. What if the second one had been signed by an email signing certificate? I mean, I thought that was an interesting point that was brought up.
I think the statement that was made by Steve before this thing even started about the fact that were I really doing this, I might have said a few more things, but we had time. There were a lot of simplifying assumptions. The bit about the time, I mean, I tried to make the point that a certificate had been issued and then the certificate had been used, and clearly I would think the inference there would have been that obviously it's within the validity date. I don't even think I even brought up the fact that after they died, was the certificate revoked or anything else, or who had control of the coupon. So I'm a token to do this good kinds of stuff. So this would have all been done. We also, in preparation for this and how much time we had, one of the things I said, of course, you'd be looking at is the robustness of the signing platform and will it do the right things? You know, will it only let you use a digital signing key? And my favorite thing, should this involve the what we call the non-repudiation, i.e. content commitment bit, we could have that discussion for hours too. But even if you just took it as a digital signing, you'd be arguing that a properly operating platform, which is what I was arguing, was being in place in both places, would have only allowed a certificate that was valid at the time it was being used and had a key usage that said this is supposed to be for digital signatures. So I made these statements that said that these systems were operating correctly as far as the digital signature technology was going. I don't know if you noticed, I was very careful to say that it is a valid digital signature. I don't think I ever said he digitally signed it.
Other folks, if you want to line up behind the microphone, I think it'll just speed things up in terms of asking questions.
Yes, suppose that the first signature had been challenged in a way that it could have been, do you think it would have been much harder to dismiss that challenge? Would it have been much likelier to be accepted?
Yes, I would have ruled in favor of the first digital signature.
That's very interesting. That's good news.
It was so
powerful. Don't cite me.
It was so reliable that I didn't even attempt to contest the first signature. Yes, sir.
Hi, I thought Mr. Wu did an excellent job of breaking apart the digital signature on the Second Amendment. There were a number of flaws in the whole security process around the actual mathematics of the digital signature. You broke down how the key was stored, the access control, the audit logs, the digital time or the secure timestamp. There are a whole number of breaks in the whole process that makes up a valid digital signature. I thought the judge's remarks and his opinions that it was a tough decision were interesting, and I wondered if you didn't have all of those technical flaws in the process, how many of those technical flaws would you need to actually find a given circumstance where you're not finding a legal valid digital signature? That is, if you didn't have all of those arguments, would it still be something you could decide?
That's a great question. I think there's a lot of pressure to take a commercial tool, which is really extremely valuable and offers a lot of hope for problems, to try to support it and to live with imperfections. There is no perfect security. And apply a risk management approach. I think a risk management balancing is the way it would be done, and in a close case, that's what I would do. There actually is authority for that in some of the older tort cases.
Hi. I was kind of curious. The one thing that wasn't raised by anybody was that any of these systems that were holding the keys could have been hacked, they could have malware, viruses, et cetera, all the usual sorts of stuff that everyone here knows about. My question is that the sort of thing that the judges and lawyers are capable of understanding and presenting and making good arguments around, or is that just so far beyond the scope that, that you can't even reasonably argue that there's a question as to, you know, maybe Richie Rich really did have that certificate issued on the 24th, but then it was hacked into, his machine was hacked into, and the private key was stolen by someone else, and so, you know, who knows who actually sent it. Is that too complex and too for a judicial proceeding?
Go ahead.
You use the material you have, and you've got to have attorneys that are alert to the slightest advantage, like David Isom making an argument of what he had.
As far as I'm concerned, I think I would have had a very difficult case to try to contest that signature if all I could rely on was an argument. Yeah, it could have, the signing platform could have been hacked. It's like those folks who are being prosecuted for child porn and say, well, gee, you know, some hacker came along and at the middle of the night on December 22nd, 2005, put this stuff on my computer. It's a hard argument to make.
In fact, we did discuss the possibility of doing this, again, exclusion for time and choosing to focus more on the proper operation of the CA. But I suggested that a second segment would be, in fact, that we'd be looking at the signing platforms. What's the policies in place? Have there been audits? Was there a forensic study of Mr. Rich's laptop after it was done? Have I gone in and done all these things? And so these questions would have certainly come up. And of course, you better hire a lawyer that understands them and hope you get a judge that understands them.
I think also the thing that worked in this case, or the thing that made it easier for Riley to contest, is the fact that these alleged flaws could somehow be tied to Agnew Rich. If these alleged flaws are just out in the air, that somebody else, some third party who had no motive for interrupting the system, if I had to rely on those third parties, it would be much more difficult.
In this case, you had two parties testifying against each other, and you had some technical evidence as well. And how much do you think the technical evidence would play a part in the final ruling compared to the trustworthiness of the parties?
I think this was all the tech. It was the trustworthiness of the technical of the implementation. I don't think we made anything of the credibility of the witnesses. Did I think that Agnes was lying, for example?
In a real case, of course, those things would be much, much more important.
Yeah, that was my question. You did a fine job to focus on the technical part, which was great. But in a real court, we had this discussion in Sweden where we have an electronic ID card. And we end up with, it will all end up with the trustworthiness of the parties. And we will hardly get into the technical discussion.
But you have assured admissibility of a digital signature in the European Union, don't you? If it is the special, as a special CA qualifications.
Yes.
So that eliminates one whole raft of issues we have here.
There are still issues that could be discussed. So we all know. Thank you.
One of the issues that some people have used against public key infrastructure in the past is that you're going to have cases in which, quote unquote, grandma signs her house away because she lost control of her private key, and so therefore she is going to be tied to that transaction. They're going to enforce that against her, and she's going to lose her house. Well, the fact of the matter is that victim would come up and say, I really didn't sign it, and would be very credible in saying that, and that's going to carry a lot of weight with the judge. So this doomsday scenario didn't seem to be much of a threat to me.
And even I didn't mean to sign it.
What's
but
a
also
computer, if you might say?
in the original development of the legality of the digital signature, was there a lot more text in those documents that was describing the basis that you used for your decision? I mean, we're sort of jumping in the middle and quickly. In addition to that, is there also any real case law? I mean, you guys made this up.
No real case law, but I'll give you some. We can certainly give you some citations. Our Information Security Committee of the American Bar Association, which is our group, start with the Digital Signature Guidelines in 1996, the PAG, the PKI Assessment Guidelines in 2001, Steve's Information Security Guide with three other people. I always forget the number of the RFC.
3647.
RFC 3647 is a rewrite by Steve and me and a couple of other people.
Can I request that when you post this on the RSA site as part of your presentation that you add a few of those in one of the later PowerPoint.
Add a new reference slide.
Sure. And if you really want to get up-to-date stuff, come see us, drop your card, and join the Information Security Committee.
I have, but others may want to just be able to go to this. And
you don't have to be an attorney to be in the Information Security Committee, one of the few places of the bar where Hoyt is a dues-paying member.
Or any committee within the Bar Association.
Okay.
Yeah.
If Agnes would have been able to bring up, say, oh, by the way, I have this paper document that my brother signed, and it's also witnessed, would that have override the digital signature and just throw in the whole digital signature?
Well, sure. If you have other evidence like that, it would weigh in the balance. It would have ruined our hypothetical, though, so we didn't do it.
But the pen is still stronger than a digital certificate.
No. I'd like to argue that I don't think so. There are so many documents that you have to have a witness sign with your signature, and you have the same kind of parallel with your digital signatures. And so if she produced a paper document and said, here's the signature, someone could challenge to say, I want to make sure it's a legitimate one, it wasn't forged. You could have the same kind of argument. It might be tougher to prove.
I'd also like the point, it depends on the order. For instance, like if there was a paper document that still had it, but had an earlier date than the digital design document, then no, you would argue the digitally signed document has exactly the same weight, and as the later document, it's the one that should carry.
I'd also like to just follow up on a comment earlier about case law. I have heard about a massive, I think I've seen this on the listserv for the ISC, a case involving an exchange of emails being held to be sufficient to form a contract for the sale of real property.
North Carolina.
Yeah.
I heard that there was one in Massachusetts.
Well, there was one in North Carolina 2 years ago. Uh-huh. The series of emails was a commitment to purchase a house, even though no digital signature was involved.
Right, and so you may have people tied to weaker forms of electronic signature. That is, the problem may not be the inability to bind somebody with a digital signature despite the strength of the technology. It may be the other problem, which is people are going to be bound to weak electronic signatures that they shouldn't be bound to.
There are at least five UEDA cases that I know of essentially validating an electronic document. A couple of them, though, really pay attention to the context and motive and fraud and that sort of thing.
That actually relates to my question. In the sense that in the case we presented here, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Rich, in putting forth the First Amendment, went through a pretty elaborate process in going through a law firm with a CA, cutting multiple keys, going through the signing procedures. Does that then imply intent and knowledge of their part on the fact that a digital signature process requires, you know, essentially authentication from the top to the bottom?
Right.
And the second signature really appears irregular, given the fact of the controls that they put in the first one.
That is
and
the
would,
point.
Would that be a valid argument as the preponderance of the evidence?
Technical people hate attorneys, so the attorneys got to him the first time, and then Richie said, oh, I don't want to go to the attorneys. They charge too much. I mean, that's what could be the fact there.
I want.
But Mr. and Mrs. Rich were technical people.
Yeah.
They were the ones that wrote this code, so I don't think you can make that argument either.
By the way, did anyone notice that about the only person on the planet who could have been caught in this argument and be held not to have inherited this property is Agne, because she had, I mean, can you imagine that Richie would have intended that? Because she was the only one with access, motive, et cetera.
Yeah, she's the only one who could have done it.
Just a comment, it's good that it's a civil situation, right? We're 51%, the burden of proof. I mean, this would have been a very tough situation to convict Agnes.
In Texas, they would have burned her.
It's funny you should say that. I didn't have my Texas shirt on. I'm actually from Austin.
I object, Your Honor. I'm from Houston.
Go Longhorns. But that's the civil situation here is the 51. That's really important.
Most of the volume of cases in the whole computer fraud are criminal cases, Criminal Fraud and Abuse Act. So that isn't that where most of the law is being developed, and they are getting convictions.
Hi. I had a question related to the code escrow bit. You had this code escrow company, and they actually ended up using, if I understand the facts of the case correctly, Mr. and Mrs. Rich actually ended up using their tokens for their first digital signatures to encrypt the contents of the code escrow. But I didn't see
No.
Two separate tokens.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Then I guess my question is, why did you bring that bid in, or was it just kind of an interesting sideline?
Actually, there was a reason to bring it in, and part of it was because you were using the same kind of digital control, and you had split control of the token and a password to use the token. And so you have this challenged operation of being able to get to the code, and then inside the vault, you have the potential of it being encrypted. So what we didn't get into is SteelSummit has this operation that said, if you lose your token legitimately as a client, we can help you open the vault, because we have to retain a way to open the vault due to legal requirements and law enforcement and whatever. But once we're inside, we have no obligation to try to open the contents. And so if you encrypt it in your only sole token and you lose a token, you're out of luck.
But they were two aspects.
Two different things. Yeah, but you have to understand the encryption.
The motive for the SteelSummit piece was twofold. One, there were news stories around the time that the call for papers went out saying that there had been soldiers in Iraq who had died in action and had email on their webmail accounts at AOL. So the question is, I wanted to highlight this aspect of what happens after death to information that's on an online repository like that. And AOL had refused to disclose that information due to their privacy policies, as they should have. But it's our belief that the court should have jurisdiction to be able to take control of that property, and the personal representative of those soldiers should be able to get at that property through a court order. The second reason for the SteelSummit scenario is to show, and especially to folks who are planning on how to set up a system of an online, of storing your enterprise information online, the token is different from the information being stored. And if they end up in two separate hands, you may have some difficulties there. So to show the dilemma of the token being in Riley's hands, possibly, and the information being given to Agnew, to show that dichotomy and how we as planners need to try to get around that problem or try to figure out a way to avoid conflict in those situations. That was the rationale.
It's all as good if no one knows the password.
Pardon?
It's all as good if no one knew the password.
That's right.
Thank you. I just wanted to say a few things. I thought this was very well done. I also want to let you know that I'm with the Office of the Chief Justice for the Province of Ontario in Canada. On March 31st, we are rolling out an electronic search warrant system which uses digital signatures and encryption. And we do approximately 15,000 search warrants a year, and we are going to be moving that into an electronic form on March 31st.
Great.
Wow. So this will be an interesting case to see whether a judge's signature on a search warrant will come into question and to its authentication as well.
Canada has led the way many times. Yeah.
Just adding on that comment, I think that the criminal realm is something that we didn't touch here, but could be a fruitful area for litigation in the future concerning digital signatures, because the stakes are so high for the criminal defendant. Those criminal defense lawyers are going to try to find whatever avenue they can to cast reasonable doubt on the prosecution's case. So in the civil realm, you might have attorneys who don't go through the effort to try to dig in these things, but in the criminal realm, you may have criminal defense lawyers who try to get into this area and challenge digital signatures. Having said that, I had read an article in the New York Times about how digital photographs are being used in prosecutions or in cases of abuse, and just wondering, I didn't see anything in those articles about the defense lawyers stepping up and questioning the chain of custody, so to speak, of the photos as they move from the camera to the courtroom. Didn't see anything about that, but I just have to think that this is going to become standard stuff in the criminal defense bar at some point soon.
With secure time date stamps before Steve Tepler gets up.
It's provenance.
Bruce Schneider actually had an article about 10 years ago talking about a digital camera that had digital signatures and secure time stamps and GPSs and all this.
It was presented here, in fact.
It was presented somewhere else first, but it was presented here. My question, where I thought you were going with the China part of the and jewelry part of the golf club token, was I thought that the password for the information in SteelSafe was going to be an inside piece of jewelry or something like that.
There you go.
But that sort of made me wonder whether if she had gotten the china and he got the, had gotten the token, could the court compel, or would a court compel, the disclosure or the sharing of the token, or what if he decides to run a big electromagnet over it and prevent her from having access to the data, because he's not destroying the data, but he's destroying the access.
And in a fit of pique, he might just want to spite his sister and
right.
destroy the data so no one gets it?
So no one gets
Good
it.
Point. I guess that would have been something that Agnes' attorney should have asked for that.
Well, we did discuss.
We did put it jointly in trust, but maybe we should have taken an escrow arrangement.
And actually, Steel Summit might have objected because we don't like to have two different people with the same token. It's an authentication mechanism. So our process would be to say, you want to give these people joint access, what we would do is revoke the other token and give them each their own. The real kick in the matter is if the contents have been encrypted using that token, that would in fact destroy access to the contents.
If you had reissued, would you give a split key in this case to make sure that neither one can act without the other?
Not without a lot of big bucks, Your Honor.
Not on my salary.
I was also going to add that the court has the authority to tell third parties, including Mr. Rich as a party of the case, you have to give up property to the trustee to take control over it. And if he were to destroy that token or in any way ruin it for gaining access, then he could be held in contempt. Other questions?
So CAs are very expensive to manage and very hard to commission, and the CA that you first recommended was very strong. So what about companies that want to start performing contracts with people, say a startup company, and they use open software and open source software, and they commission their own CA, and they now are going to perform contracts with their companies? Are they going to be considered valid signatures because they haven't been, commissioned with all this money and, filmed and everything?
Well, I love this answer because I go do audits sometimes. And in reality, the process of dual controls ain't that damn expensive. In my opinion, I find that it either is caused because people are lazy or don't understand, or because there are people who don't like to be frozen out. I mean, a CEO doesn't like to say he can't go look at everything he wants to do. But I don't think that cost is the impediment of putting decent controls on a certification authority.
And do you want to add something there?
Actually, I think it would be wise to have an independent third party help certify your signatures so that you don't get in this kind of argument. If you have internal controls and you're using self-signed certificates, there's always going to be this cloud of whether or not somebody was capable of messing up a control. So if it's an important thing, I'd say make sure you get that third-party CA. If it's internal stuff and it's not that expensive and you want to take the risk, it's all a risk management kind of situation. Sign it yourself.
It's a huge debate now between the browsers like Microsoft, who worry about the low-budget, lower-budget CA on SSL certificates, which we're all using every minute of every day, and there's thinking that has to be reversed.
I'm going to actually do a little argument with Ann here, because even if I go to a third party, I still have the issue of the registration authority, which is still going to be under the control of the company. If I were the technical expert trying to find flaw, I wouldn't go after the CA, I'd go after the RA process. Again, I argue you have to have decent controls. You have to have a system that forces you to be honest.
One other thing I would mention is you might have a course of dealing between two small companies that really can't afford big CA systems. They've used it reliably for years, and then all of a sudden something goes awry. Would it be able to hold up? Well, in the context of what I just described, perhaps. It's going to depend on the facts and circumstances of the case, but you've had two parties that have trusted each other under the circumstances in the past. But if you had a company that just sort of out of the blue adopted this and very soon after tried to do a transaction with a consumer, I think you're going to run into a lot more trouble. Also, I want to mention a couple of other points. I mean, we didn't really do too much on the slides, but wanted to mention that my feeling in putting together the scenario with an estate planning scenario as opposed to something like some huge trade secret theft with espionage and high-tech this and CSI that, the point of that was to say that a lot of what we may see in the future about electronic signature litigation may be in what we would consider very mundane cases, things that aren't really that jazzy. But that all of these things added together All of the mundane cases produce a body of law and a rule of law that that form the backbone of our legal system. So it might not be a sexy case. I'm told that that we need to stop. So unless there are any other questions, I want to thank you all for coming and being with us today.